and welcome to The History of Philosophy in China by Peter Adamson and Karen Lai, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, The Only Constant, Change and the I Ching. Kong Zi, often known as Confucius in the West, once said that when he engaged in divination, he got it correct only 70 out of 100 times. What is divination, and can it be that one of China's foremost sages is only a 70% achiever? The practice of divination, broadly speaking, is to forecast what might happen in the future. It was widely practiced and documented in Chinese texts from as early as the 9th century BCE. You might already know something about the Book of Changes, or the I Ching. Parts of this text were compiled almost 3,000 years ago. The I Ching is a multi-layered text in more ways than one. Its different parts were put together in different periods, and these different layers served quite different functions. Its earliest sections were used for divination, while the latter ones record reflections on the process of divination and the place of divination in life. The earlier layer is made up of sections containing hexagram symbols made up of 6 lines in a stack. These symbols were accompanied by statements about each hexagram, as well as a line statement for each of the 6 lines of every hexagram. The lines that make up the hexagrams are either broken or continuous, traditionally associated with the familiar pairing yin and yang, respectively. Yin has a range of connotations, including shade, cold, and femininity, and yang is associated with light, warmth, and masculinity. The 6-line figures that may be a combination of broken or continuous lines allow for 64 permutations of hexagrams in total. The hexagrams, its statements, and the line statements are often referred to in a set as the Zhou Yi. The compilation of this layer is understood to be associated with the Zhou people who lived in the Zhou plains. The Zhou dynasty is also named after the people who lived here. In divination practices involving the use of the Zhou Yi layer, typically milfoil or yarrow stalks would be used to determine the appropriate hexagram relating to an inquirer's question. Inquirers could come with questions on any matter, for example, on health, marriage, childbearing, or travel. Rulers and courts might seek to ascertain whether it is auspicious or inauspicious to carry out military advances at particular times, about harvests, natural disasters, or climatic changes. The forecast for the inquirer would be determined in relation to a particular hexagram identified by the use of the milfoil stalks, and the hexagram's associated statements and line statements would be interpreted accordingly. What was the purpose of divination for the early Chinese, of their attempts to know what the future holds? Edward Shaughnessy, an expert on early China and in particular on the I Ching, suggests 3 broad reasons: to resolve doubt, to have one's intention confirmed, and to engage in communion with spirits. The layer of the I Ching that was added subsequently allows us glimpses into the motivations underlying assumptions and processes of divination practices. These 10 commentaries, or appendices, which were already referred to in the early Han period, around 200 BCE, are known as the 10 wings, Shi Yi. The 10 wings, together with the earlier layer of hexagram figures, statements, and line statements, that is, the Zhou Yi, comprise what we call the I Ching. As the 10 wings reflect on the nature of divination, its discussions reveal the motivations for developing a system that aids in foretelling the future. We are told in the Ji Zi Suan, one of the appendices, that anxiety prompted this. As for the rise of the changes, was it not in middle antiquity? Was the maker of the changes not one with worries and anxieties? We can, of course, understand that life brings many worries, especially during a time prior to effective storage of food, machines to assist with work, a scientific understanding of human health, medicines to treat illnesses, and when the majority could not independently access information. Anxiety about the lack of stability in life drove many, it seems, to try to predict how future events might turn out. Hence the text, A Tool for Divination, is named The Changes, expressing anticipation of change, apprehension about it, and a desire to accurately predict what is to come. From this perspective, divination can be considered an epistemological tool, that is, a technique for achieving knowledge and control over events. This is also something we saw when we looked at divination in the context of traditional African practices. Change is also associated with the ideas of alternation and transformation, bianhua, in the Si Zi Suan. In the words of Edward Shaughnessy, a diviner needs to grasp the alternation or oscillation between 2 opposed poles, or the ebb and flow of events, so as to intuit how and when these changes will take place. Divination practices were widespread during the Zhou dynasty, prior to it and after it, and we should not assume that what we call texts, such as the changes, written on bamboo slips or silk, were the only tools. Another method was to create lines on ox scapula and turtle plastrons with a heated instrument, and then read the cracks that formed. So in a way, these could be considered texts too. So popular was the I Ching that there were many versions of appendices that accompanied the Zhou Yi, the earlier hexagram layer. In some of the versions, there were even differences in the Zhou Yi itself, in the order of hexagrams, which reflected different rationales for placing the hexagrams in relation to each other. For example, one version of the I Ching, excavated from a tomb in Ma Guangdui in 1937, has a different hexagram order than in the extant I Ching. The Ma Wangdui I Ching also includes other appendices not found in the 10 wings of the I Ching. Kongsu's comment that he did not do so well in divination appears in one of the Ma Wangdui appendices. More versions of the I Ching have been excavated, prompting questions about the nature of these texts and the level of interest in it. That there are this many versions of the text to date, both extant and excavated, suggests the high likelihood that there were many more circulating over the course of the 4th and 3rd centuries BCE. These texts captured both the popular and philosophical imagination of the Chinese. A key debate on the significance of the I Ching concerns whether we see it as an oracle text or as one that is more reflective about one's priorities, typically in connection with Confucian virtues. These positions were in part tied up with how the layers of the I Ching were accentuated and how they were organized. For example, Wang Bi, a prominent 3rd century CE thinker who annotated many classical texts, rearranged the layers of the I Ching, incorporating sections from the 10 wings with the hexagrams in the Zhou Yi portions. His intention, allegedly, was to remove the speculation associated with the study of the I Ching that dominated debates during the Han Dynasty. Yet much later, the influential Neo-Confucian thinker Zhu Ci sought to revive the I Ching as an oracle text, and did so by organizing the 10 wings separately from the Zhou Yi. Let us now turn to some of the more reflective views expressed in the 10 wings on the nature of change and humanity's possible responses to it. In the Ji Zi Cuan, one of the 10 wings appendices, Kongzi is depicted as advising that we should not expect things around us to continue in the way they've been going. This is good advice. To take a not-so-random example, dangerous pandemics can erupt with great suddenness, and the more we have assumed that things would go on being the same, the less ready we will be to deal with such challenges. Kongzi is effectively telling us to anticipate change. In this same passage from the Zi Zi Cuan, he says that a person might find themselves endangered if they believe their position is secure. They might suffer severe losses if they expect always to maintain what they have, and chaos might result from their belief that order will endure. These statements are intended to shake readers out of their complacency. The thrust of this advice is that it is naive to expect that things will continue along in the same way. Kongzi brings his wise counsel to a close by suggesting that we should take steps to ensure that what we value is properly established and anchored. Quoting advice from a section of the Zhou Yi, Kongzi says, "The changes say, this might be lost, this might be lost, so tie it to a healthy, flourishing mulberry." This metaphorical statement expresses Kongzi's response to change, which is to ensure that what we value most will be able to withstand whatever comes ahead. This passage leans on the figure of Kongzi to express its particular view on how a person can set themselves up to cope with change. There are other images of Kongzi in the appendices of the I Ching, including his comment about getting divination right only 70% of the time. We might connect this modest remark to what he then says as the passage continues. Kongzi informs his follower, Zigong, that in his use of the Zhou Yi, he distinguishes himself from scribes and shamans. Kongzi says that he uses the text in some ways, as the others do, but unlike them, he does not seek fortune nor only to be in auspicious circumstances. His is a different destination, Kongzi claims. He seeks the virtue of the I Ching. Kongzi was not himself the author of these appendices, but rather he was portrayed as master in many versions of the I Ching. The historian Richard Rutt has reminded us that such attempts to install Kongzi as the master in the I Ching are found only after the Han Dynasty. Rutt writes that there is no evidence that prior to the Han, the I Ching was ever considered Confucian. Moreover, ongoing debates among scholars about whether the Ma Wang Dui appendices are more closely aligned with Taoist or Confucian views should alert us to the fact that our understanding of the I Ching should extend beyond its association with Confucianism. We know that the Zhou Yi was used widely across Chinese society for a long period of time, and it is highly likely that its views on predicting and responding to change would have been shared more widely among thinkers of different persuasions. In the remainder of this episode, we will consider how some assumptions concerning change have permeated early Chinese philosophy. We look at this issue through a particular angle, thinking about how it is possible to prepare for change. We seek some answers through an unusual but illuminating approach, which is to explore models of exemplary people and sages in a number of different traditions. It stands to reason that early Chinese thinkers would have thought about how we can best harness and develop human capacities in order to be resourceful and resilient in the face of change. It also makes sense that these desirable qualities would be embodied by exemplary people. We've seen in the last episode that the Confucian Dao provides guidance for people to develop appropriate dispositions and capacities. We could say that in this tradition, the most important method for growing in this way is to learn from models. This is how we learn, says Kongzi in the Analects, a text that supposedly records his conversations. Kongzi commented that, among three people, he will always find teachers. He selects what is desirable in them so that he may himself pursue those ways. And with what is undesirable, he corrects himself. Which reminds me of something my grandfather, who was himself something of a sage, used to say, everyone is useful if only to serve as a bad example. Belief in the power of example undergirds Confucian political philosophy. Ideally, the king who embodies benevolence, ren, in all his undertakings and interactions will transform his people morally. In the Mengzi, a major Warring States Confucian text, a benevolent king is at the center of benevolent government. This idealistic picture is filled out with details of how a benevolent king would treat his people well and would watch over their material well-being. In the Confucian tradition, the highest accolade for a king is sage or sage king. The idea of sageliness cannot be confined to a theoretical definition. They are most often portrayed as embodying virtue. For example, sage king Yao built canals to divert floods and installed a succession plan, amongst his other achievements. Sage king Shun was exemplary in filial devotion, as we saw last episode, and Kongzi is known as the sage of timeliness, even though Kongzi never regarded himself as a sage. The idea of timeliness helps us better understand how a person responds to changing circumstances. For example, Kongzi's decisions are timely because he knows when he should take on an official position, when he should withdraw, and when he should continue. The Shunzi, another Confucian text, discusses the adaptiveness of the sage to different circumstances. One passage specifically addresses the question of how to engage in argument or disputation. The sage says what is appropriate in circumstances, and his responsiveness to change, presumably the turns in argument taken by his opponents, is inexhaustible. A comment in the Mengzi sums up well the idea that acting virtuously, as a sage does, can vary depending on circumstances. It says, the sages have differed in their actions. The point of convergence has been in keeping their persons pure. That is all. The Mengzi, in particular, shows rather than tells us what sageliness is, thereby using literary methods that align closely with its own commitment to learning from models. What we have so far is a picture of Confucian sage kings who act responsively to change. This sits uncomfortably with a widespread view of Confucian philosophy as traditionalist and focused on compliance. Could it be that early Confucianism offers a two-tiered morality, one for the sages and another for everyone else? According to this view, discretion is an option only for those deemed exemplary or who are sages. A less jarring account of Confucian philosophy might instead explain the use of discretion and the emphasis on compliance differently. The guiding hand is more prominent in a person's earlier stages of moral development, with compliance being an aspect of these stages. Discretion comes later, as one gains maturity in reflection. The level of discretion as befits sages is only for the few, at least in Mengzi and Xunzi's time. We'll revisit these questions in later episodes on Confucian philosophy. The trust Confucians place on sages is absent among a set of thinkers commonly known as legalist. This phrase is misleading, as not only do the texts collected under this grouping have diverse themes, but the views on law barely correspond to what we designate by the terms legal and law. the term Chinese legalism is a simple translation of the term Fajia, referring to those who emphasized penal law as a method for the state to control unruly behavior. However, the term Fajia itself is a facile oversimplification of a set of texts that move well beyond the use of penal law. We'll have more to say about these Fa thinkers in a later episode. Of the Fa group texts, the most prominent is the Han Fei Zi, bearing the name of the thinker Han Fei. This is a multifaceted text with different views, including reflections on the capacities of the ruler. Compared with the Confucian trust in sage kings to exercise discretion in handling matters, the Han Fei Zi is less confident about the capacities of rulers. Therefore, it presents a range of strategies to enable rulers to hold on to power. One of these tells a ruler how he should keep his advisors in check, for in handling state matters, they could deceive him, or worse still, they could be traitorous. In Chapter 5, entitled The Ruler's Dao, the ruler is told he needs to be inscrutable. He hides the fact that he is keenly watching over his advisors, appearing as if he takes no action, Wu Wei, in ruling the state. However, he holds his advisors to account, ensuring that their proposals are carried out. He maintains a tally system, and advisors who fail to carry out their assignments and duties will be punished. Another chapter of the Han Fei Zi responds to advocates of a virtuous ruler. In the Objection to Positional Power chapter, an extended argument is made against rule by the morally worthy. The Han Fei Zi argues against a view that was held by many, that the worthy should rule. Instead, it states that what is needed to maintain the state is the ruler's positional power, shi. In a compelling argument, it says that because both sages and tyrants are rare, they must be a system to ensure that average rulers are able to maintain control of the state. It sets up analogies in its argument against the widely held belief that rulers must be persons of moral worth. If a famished person does not eat for 100 days while waiting for fine millet and meat, he will not survive. If you wait for a great sea swimmer from Yue in order to save someone who is drowning in the central states, though the people from Yue are good enough at swimming, the person who is drowning will not be helped. Waiting for a sage king to turn up, such as Yao or Shun, is analogous to these scenarios, the Han Fei Zi argues, which renders that model of leadership unviable. This is a vision of political leadership that stands in stark contrast to that offered by the Confucians. Lacking confidence in the people who might actually take up positions of power, the Han Fei Zi does not expect the ruler to exercise discretion in response to changing circumstances. Perhaps it even prefers that the ruler not exercise discretion. Yuri Pines, a scholar of the philosophy of the Fa thinkers, suggests that this is one way the Han Fei Zi safeguards rulers from their own weaknesses. Reliance on the ruler's status, as well as his use of other instruments to wield control over the people and his advisors, reduces the ruler's discretion to a minimum. According to this view, the Han Fei Zi's image of the ruler is set within a system that is built to withstand change rather than respond to it. A sage in Taoist philosophy could not be more different from a ruler in the Han Fei Zi. A Taoist sage acts in a manner characterized as Wu Wei, translated literally as non-action. We've seen in relation to the Han Fei Zi that the ruler, in being Wu Wei, hides his intentions from his advisors as if he were not acting. The Taoists too speak of Wu Wei, but mean something quite different by it. Far from suggesting that a sage takes no action, it refers to action that is not constrained by specific methods or outcomes. This will make more sense if we look more closely at the meaning of the term, Wu Wei. The word Wei does mean to act, but also to regard things as being a certain way. For example, we could say that a Confucian regards Wei, benevolence, as a unique and basic aspect of all human life. And we could also say that the Confucian engages in projects, Wei, in order to grow their benevolence. Taoist Wu Wei, by contrast, resists thinking that is hemmed in by certain expectations or action that is goal-driven. So the negation Wu in Wu Wei expresses its refusal to go along with conventional goal-directed projects. The Tao Te Ching, a late Warring States text containing 81 passages by different authors, rejects conventional ways of valuing and thinking about things. It exposes the way preoccupations about beauty, goodness, benevolence, rightness, wisdom, learning, fame, possessions, skill or cunning, and gain dictate our lives. It would seem odd that a text would seek only to negate all pursuits. In fact, though, the Tao Te Ching does not reject all forms of goodness or indeed of sageliness. where it speaks against learning, for example, it criticizes those approaches to learning that seek to increase a person's conventional wisdom. By contrast, the Tao Te Ching aims to engage in matters without embracing expectations that most people hold to. According to Tao Te Ching, Chapter 2, the Taoist sage carries out tasks without being constrained in this way. The chapter opens by scrutinizing how our pursuits are shaped by our views of what is beautiful and of what is good. It then asserts that the sage's pursuits are not shaped in this way. Indeed, they are wu wei. Because the Taoist sage does not encourage a specific set of values, he, like the Han Fei Zi's ruler, does not promote worthiness as a criterion of leadership. Yet it is for different reasons that the two texts reject worthiness. The Han Fei Zi thinks insistence on worthiness is unrealistic, as rulers in its day were merely average. In comparison, the Tao Te Ching is concerned about the imposition of norms on human behavior. Moreover, unlike the Han Fei Zi's ruler, for whom Wu Wei has an element of passivity, the Taoist sage who embodies Wu Wei actively engages with the world. It is difficult to form a more complete picture of sagely Wu Wei from the Tao Te Ching, given its cryptic nature. However, it is possible to illustrate what a Taoist sagely life might be like by referring to a story from the Shuangzi. In the last episode, we saw that the Shuangzi's Tao incorporates open-endedness as a person journeys through life. This idea is related to sagely Wu Wei. In fact, Taoist Tao is Wu Wei in that it is not molded into a particular form, like a fixed itinerary for everyone. In both Taoist conceptions of Tao and Wu Wei, a primary focus is on living a life that encounters the changing world responsibly. A story in the Shuangzi about a wheel maker helps us appreciate how it is possible to act in such a way. The wheelmaker, whose name means flat, has the audacity to remark that an official, Duke Huan, is reading the words of men who were long dead. These remarks would have been particularly offensive, as the Duke had just told the wheelmaker that he was reading the words of the sages. The story sets up how the Duke and the wheelmaker are worlds apart in status. And the story overturns this conventional setup. The manual worker challenges the appropriately focused official who aims to learn from former sages. This is a story of contrasts. While the Duke reads so that he may be reliably guided by the wisdom of the sages, the wheelmaker highlights the freehand nature of his work. He says of his work that, with his hammer and chisel, I feel it in my hand and respond to it with my heart mind. Most workmen in his day would have been guided by measuring instruments, collectively called compass and square, guizhu. However, this wheelmaker undertakes his craft by feel, responding to the wood he is carving with his hammer and chisel. It's also important to mention that the generic term for measuring instruments, compass and square, was also used metaphorically by the Confucians to refer to guidance for our moral lives. Toward the end of the story, the wheelmaker tells the Duke that he cannot put his firsthand experience of wheelmaking into words and that he has been unable to transmit it to his son. This is intended to be instructive for those who seek to preserve the wisdom of sages for the present. How can words transmit to us what it means to act responsibly? The story's point is not that reading is a pointless exercise. Rather, its question concerns how we can learn to be responsive to changing circumstances. Can it be that sages' words, which codify values and practices, enable us to be responsive? So responsive decision-making is a characteristic of both Confucian and Taoist sages. Whereas in the Han Fei Zi, discretion is not encouraged, nor is it nurtured, as it is difficult to ensure that rulers will be able reliably to exercise it. The Han Fei Zi's focus is therefore on certain strategies and power infrastructure that will persist in spite of change. We've also considered differences in the ways the Confucians and Taoists seek to respond to change. While Confucians look to tried and tested ways for guidance, so that they might act as a sage might have in their circumstances, the Taoist Wu Wei sage seeks to encounter the world and respond to it attentively. An idea that sums up the difference between the two views of sagely responsiveness is in their thinking about the tracks that sages lead for us to follow. The Tsun Tzu, a Confucian text, discusses how we can discern and follow the tracks of sage kings. By contrast, the two Taoist texts we have looked at speak of not leaving tracks. The Shuangzi specifically addresses this issue, highlighting the difference between what it sees as a Confucian approach in contrast to its own. In a conversation between Lao Dan, the revered author of the Tao Te Ching, and Kongzi, Lao Dan rejects Kongzi's reliance on the six classics, the Confucian canon of texts. Characterizing the six classics as the tracks or footprints of former kings, Lao Dan says, "Those six classics are indeed just the stale footprints of the former kings. How could they be that which leaves the footprints? Now, your present words are just further footprints. Footprints are produced by the gate, but they are not the gate itself." These comments crystallize the complexity surrounding the question of how we can effectively draw on the insights of sages, models, and exemplary people so that their own views can be better informed. How can we learn from the past in such a way that it enhances, rather than inhibits, our encounters with the world? In these opening two episodes, we've pursued a couple of major themes in classical Chinese philosophy, the Tao, and now change, to give you an introduction to the main currents of thought and a flavor of what is to come. You'll hear more about this in the next episode, as I chat with the co-author of this series, Karen Lai, about the chronological and thematic scope of the whole series we're planning. To be honest, we're going to have to exercise some discretion as we go along in response to changing circumstances, but it would still be sage advice for you to join me and Karen here next time on The History of Philosophy in China.